Hello, and welcome back to the Alterity and Western Art Music Podcast. I'm Drew.
And I'm Justin. In our last episode, we used the concept of alterity to discuss how dominant narratives of classical music in the United States tend to exclude certain groups of people.
In our case study on Antonín Dvořák, in his 1893 New World Symphony, we described the complexities of alterity during his stay in the United States. Dvořák was cast as foreign or exotic other in the United States and in the classical music canon, but he also contributed to the exclusion of Black Native Americans from American high culture. In other words, the case of the New World Symphony demonstrates multiple levels of alterity and exoticism, while also revealing an early example of white supremacy in the American musical mind.
In this episode, we turn our attention to composer Florence Price's career in the 1930s. The premiere of her Symphony No. 1 in E minor at the 1933 Chicago World's Fair received glowing critical acclaim. Yet, it has only been in the past few years that this work has re-entered the performance repertoire of major American symphony orchestras. While hardly any concert season would be complete without a performance of Dvořák's symphony from the New World ever since its 1893 premiere.
But to say that Price was excluded from classical music would be an oversight. She did, after all, experience great success at various points in her career and found an advocate in musicologist Dr. Ray Linda Brown since the 1980s. So how can we talk about how alterity has played out in Price's career and legacy without labeling her as the other? In other words, how can we acknowledge the unique obstacles that she faced as a Black woman in the field of classical music, but at the same time respect the fact that her success was not an accident? For this, we turn to the framework of intersectionality.
Simply put, intersectionality describes the intersection of one's multifaceted identities: race, gender, sexuality, class, etc. The term was coined by Black feminist scholar Kimberly Williams Crenshaw to describe how neither gender nor racial discrimination adequately explain the unique discrimination faced by Black women in U.S. society.
So it occurred to me, maybe a simple analogy to an intersection.
That's Crenshaw herself in her 2016 TED Talk.
So if we think about this intersection, the roads to the intersection would be the way that the workforce was structured by race and by gender. And then the traffic in those roads would be the hiring policies and the other practices that ran through those roads. Now, because Emma was both Black and female, she was positioned precisely where those roads overlapped, experiencing the simultaneous impact of the company's gender and race traffic. So, what do you call being impacted by multiple forces and then abandoned to fend for yourself? Intersectionality seemed to do it for me. I would go on to learn that African-American women, like other women of color, like other socially marginalized people all over the world, were facing all kinds of dilemmas and challenges as a consequence of intersectionality, intersections of race and gender, of heterosexism, transphobia, xenophobia, ableism. All of these social dynamics come together and create challenges that are sometimes quite unique.
In the case of Dvořák, intersectionality can be used to describe how his intersecting identities as a white man from Europe helped enable his career and privilege his reception in the United States. At the same time, his humble beginnings in Czech ethnicity represented barriers to his reception in Europe.
Florence Price's background could hardly be more different. Price was an African-American woman of considerable social status and education, a wife, and later a single mother. Yet she too was an active professional composer in the Western art music tradition.
Intersectionality is absolutely essential because what it helps us understand within Price's context is the layers of privilege and discrimination.
That's musicologist and Florence Price expert A. Corey Hill.
She recognized that she wasn't as overt and like, hey, you know, hey, y'all, play my stuff, as she recognized she needed to be to really get her music out there. And it's not only just because she's a Black woman writing classical music, but it's also because of the systems of patronage within classical music. And normally with intersectionality, we, you know, it's typically in regards to how race, gender, class, sexual orientation can, not impede, but how societal systems penalize certain identities within those categories and thus impact resources that people or communities have access to. But I also think intersectionality is a very important tool to get into the layers of privilege within how classical composers get commissioned, how they get, you know, steady requests from certain ensembles or certain people. Because even with Price writing consistently for Marian Anderson, even though she is often mentioned in the Chicago Defender, that did not translate into long-term mainstream attention after her death.
In 1887, Florence Beatrice Price was born in Little Rock, Arkansas, to an affluent couple considered among the Black elite, Florence Gulliver, a school teacher, and James Smith, the city's only Black dentist. Graduating as her high school's valedictorian at the age of 14, Price left Little Rock in 1903 to attend the New England Conservatory of Music, one of the nation's most elite music institutions. Her middle-class social status certainly helped enable her acceptance there, but she was always wary of the obstacles that being Black posed in a predominantly white institution.
When she was at New England, she even had a separate apartment because this was a few decades before Florence got there. Another Black student, Mark Cooney Hare, was accepted, went to New England, but there ended up being controversy because her white roommate didn't want to room with her once she found out that she was Black. And with Price's case, her mother, I guess, didn't even want to have to worry about that. She was very protective of her daughter in ways that often involved what is considered racial passing. Because in the last year that Price was at New England, it's recorded that she was from a city in Mexico, which would have racialized her a different way than if she was like, you know, I'm from Little Rock, Arkansas.
In 1912, Florence returned to Little Rock and married Thomas Price, a successful young lawyer. In the subsequent years, she gave birth to her children Florence Louise and Edith Cassandra. Her time in Little Rock was spent primarily as a mother and private piano teacher, but this period also marked the beginnings of her compositional success. As early as 1926, she won a song contest for her piece At the Cotton Gin, a Southern Sketch, winning both a cash prize and a publication of the piece by G. Shermer. In 1928, however, the Price family decided to relocate to Chicago due to a combination of financial difficulties and the escalating racial violence against prominent Black families in Little Rock.
Chicago is where Price's compositional career really took off. We have already mentioned the premiere of her Symphony No. 1 by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, but equally important were the publications of her pieces and her connections to the Chicago Black Renaissance. Much of Florence Price's music is influenced by the African-American spiritual tradition and became a key part of her compositional style. In this regard, Price continued the long-standing tradition of incorporating African-American musical idioms to create the great American art music tradition described by Dvorak decades earlier.
So the New Negro, this concept that develops in post-Civil War America, where Black Americans are seeking to define themselves historiographically, culturally, and socially outside of the enslavement system. And part of that is not only a continuation of cultural practices from the enslavement period, but also the kind of like stitching together of historical genealogy of music traditions, while also talking about and arguing about and coming to terms with what a Black music culture in the emancipation period should look like.
But Price's approach differed from Dvorak's in several key ways. For one, she sometimes quoted spirituals directly, as opposed to the made-up spirituals heard in Dvorak's New World Symphony. Additionally, Price's music was influenced by her collaborations with Black Chicago-based artists such as Langston Hughes, Lawrence Dunbar, Catherine Dunham, and Margaret Bonds.
The circle she was involved with in Chicago, her own upbringing, and the writings that she did, that we do have from her, that talk about her ideas of Black music's place within an American classical music style, it's very much aligns with some of the core tenets of New Negro ideology, where it's like recuperation, reconstruction, and tradition building. And then with the spirituals, that repertoire would be considered like sacred vocal repertoire that also developed amongst slave communities, where it was not only part of worship practice, but also a method of expressing hopes and desires and aims for freedom and emancipation. Folks in Price's circle, the spirituals became the folk music that they looked to and drew upon within their compositions. It's this look at the very recent musical past of Black America and saying, okay, how can this figure creatively in my own work, and how can it figure creatively in our expression of this is not only Black American music, this is American classical music? Because another thing with Price is she wanted Black culture's contributions to American culture to be acknowledged as part of a whole, instead of like with Clarence Cameron White, where he kind of developed much more of a, we have to like create a space for Black folk, like a Black classical aesthetic.
This is one of the greatest differences between Price's and Dvorak's approach to African-American musical idioms, respect. While Dvorak's use of so-called spirituals in his New World Symphony may have come from a place of good intention, he ultimately saw himself as uplifting music of quote-unquote primitive peoples, to the height of art through its inclusion in a symphonic piece.
Price, on the other hand, demonstrated a deep commitment to ethically representing spirituals in her music. Of course, there is a sense that Price, too, saw Western art music as uplifting the spiritual tradition. But she more so saw this as contributing to the recognition of African Americans, rather than extracting this music from the other for her own individual gain.
Florence Price's Symphony in E Minor, she was originally going to subtitle it. She's going to subtitle like the Negro Symphony and end up dropping it, and it was just Symphony in E Minor. And here we see how she is not only integrating melodic and harmonic aspects of spirituals and Juba dance, but also structural components as well. I'm thinking like in terms of form. With the third movement, and this is with all four of her symphonies, all the third movements are labeled Juba, and all of them are based on rhythmic motives, either pulled directly from Juba or meant to conjure associations with that dance form. And that, for me, it really speaks to her, how conscious she is of stylistic practices and formal similarities between Western classical repertoire and African American folk traditions.
Perhaps this is an unfair characterization of Dvorak's approach to spirituals. After all, he did not have the same access to this tradition that Price did as a Black woman from the American South, a case in which we see intersectionality privileging Price's identity over Dvorak's. But maybe we can be okay with Dvorak taking this hit. His legacy seems to be doing all right. The main point we want to make here is that Price takes a more loving approach to alterity in her music, and for that, she is worthy of more recognition.
So, to return to a question we posed at the beginning of this podcast, how can we talk about how alterity has played out in Price's career and legacy without labeling her as the other? Florence Price was an individual who both participated in the elitism of classical music, but at the same time subtly used her career to create a space for African Americans in the Western art music tradition.
The significance of this last point cannot be overstated, because even today, there are institutional barriers and social stigmas that hinder the participation of African Americans in classical music. Classical saxophonist Stephen Banks has noted this in his own TED Talk.
As many young people, I spent a lot of my life trying to find a sense of belonging in the world and in my field. As a musician myself, I spent a lot of time performing and practicing and meeting with conductors and professors that don't look like me, about the music of composers that don't look like me either. In my everyday endeavors, performing and having class and my other things outside of school, I'm often the only black person in the room. Many times, I find myself being the only person of color at all. I felt that I was spending my life pursuing an art that simply wasn't meant for me. However, since this time, I've come a long way to realize that the contributions of minorities and women in the arts have been going on since the 18th century and before. Now, this brought me to a very common place where minorities often occupy, seeing that people of their background have been doing amazing things in the field and contributing to our society, yet they ask themselves questions like, why didn't I know about this? Why didn't I learn about this in school? The work of people of color has been marginalized as a side note, if it's mentioned at all.
As Price's career demonstrates, being black in a classical composer is not a contradiction. And the more we talk about Florence Price and listen to her music, the more we can begin to break down these social stigmas, so that anyone should feel empowered to participate in classical music or not, regardless of intersectional identity.